Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is P.L. Stewart, author of the novel A Drowned Kingdom. P.L., welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Jeff. I'm honored to be here.
Sure. Well, if someone hasn't yet heard about your novel, how would you describe your novel?
I would describe my novel as high epic fantasy imaginative world building, some stirring battle scenes, and some very compelling and thought-provoking themes in the novel.
And do you remember the original idea or impetus that prompted you to write A Drowned Kingdom?
Well, Jeff, this idea was germinating for a long time, essentially since high school, and it took on various iterations. But eventually, in my late 40s, almost 50s, it became the novel that was published recently in February, A Drowned Kingdom. A long time percolating, so.
And can you tell me kind of about your writing journey during those years? Were you working on short stories? You said that this was a idea that you had back to high school. Did you write multiple drafts? Can you kind of tell us a little bit about your writing journey through the years?
Well, it's funny. In high school, I wrote for a community newspaper, a local newspaper. Actually, I was writing sports, of all things, very different from fantasy. They offered me a job there. I declined because I wanted to finish high school, go to university. In university, I majored in English with a minor in history, and my specialization was medieval literature. So back then, I conceived writing something that was very much based on my version of Plato's Tale of Atlantis. I started some drafts, then never finished them. Life continued to get really busy, hectic, raising a family. Writing took a real backseat. And then eventually, at a point much later in life, when you're, you know, pretty well an empty nester, I really settled down and thought, okay, you know, I got to get this done if, you know, I'm almost 50, so I have more than half my life is probably behind me. So I need to get this done. So then I picked it up. And about 3 years later, I came up with A Drowned Kingdom. So I'm very happy about
it. And so what was the writing process for you, let's say, when you picked it up, as you just mentioned and said, like, now's the time for me to write this? Had you outline the novel? Was it completely written at that point and you revised? Can you just tell us a little bit about kind of the writing process?
Well, funny enough, I started from scratch with just some real cursory ideas around 3 years ago. I wrote a book that would essentially be the equivalent of, 6 or 7 400 page books. So I decided, well, no one's going to want to read that. I'm not George R. R. Martin. No one's going to want to read my 1,500, 2,000-page book. So I chopped it into 7 pieces, essentially. So the guts of the 7 books in the series I have planned is nominally written. It's just a lot of revision and adding things. But I do have an outline. I actually have an outline for a 20-book universe based on this exact thing. But the first 7 books is a series based on primarily one character. His name's Othryn. He's a prince of the Atalanteans, and he's very controversial, got some very bigoted and flawed views, but I think people will find him very interesting, and he's the focus of the sub-books in the main series called The Drowned Kingdom Saga, of which A Drowned Kingdom is the first book.
And so you said it's the first book. Are you hard at work on the second book?
Yes, I am. I'm hoping to have the second book ready to go to editing sometime in the late summer. And then with all luck, A Drowned Kingdom was published in February 2021. And I'm planning for the next book called The Last of the Atalanteans to be published around the same time, hopefully in February or March 2022.
And how does it feel to finally have your book out there after all those years of kind of thinking about the idea? I mean, you said it was all the way back to high school.
Yeah, Jeff, it's really overwhelming. I've been humbled by the response. The one thing I've realized, though, that, a writer's work is never done, especially if you plan to write a series and you're only as good as your most recent book and your most recent success. So I'm putting all my energies forward into making The Last of the Atalanteans hopefully even better than A Drowned Kingdom, and so on and so on as the series continues. So,
And are you seeing a kind of difference in your writing between A Drowned Kingdom and the second book?
Well, hopefully I'm getting better. Hopefully I'm improving. You know, I think with your first book, I think a lot of authors would agree, you know, it's almost like an anomaly. You have your, what you believe is your style. You start off, you write your book, and then you get feedback and, you know, you get critiques and you see things in your own writing you'd like to improve, and some things that, you know, you feel work really well. And hopefully you continue to, you know, develop and evolve as a writer and make your writing even better. Sorry. And that's what I'm working on.
Sure. And can you tell us a little bit? I mean, you just mentioned that briefly you were talking about some of the ideas and philosophies of this major character that are somewhat problematic. Can you talk about kind of your decision to do that?
Well, the main character, Othryn, he's very bigoted. You know, the book is filled with themes of patriarchy, colonialism, sexism, misogyny, homophobia, religious intolerance and persecution. Those are all things that I feel, unfortunately, are still very much front and center in today's world. And I tried to make the book relatable to those themes, because I think those themes, unfortunately, are timeless, a lot of them, and are still, you know, burdening us and weighing us down today. So I wanted my book, although it's fantasy, to be tied into those themes, and not so much as to, you know, find resolutions, because I think those are problems that have plagued us, you know, as long as humankind's been around, but more or less incite discussion and kind of exploration of those topics.
Sure. So given your experience of finally getting A Drowned Kingdom written and published, as you said, in your late 40s, what writing advice would you offer for those who are listening who are working on their own stories and novels?
Well, certainly don't give up. Perseverance. If someone like me can do it, publishing at 52, anyone could do it. Writing is a long game, and books, especially novels, normally take a long time to write. So stick with it, especially, you know, for those pursuing the traditional publishing path. I didn't pursue that path. I went the self-publishing route. However, I find both routes or some hybrid of in between is equally viable today. And because the traditional route involves, you know, querying, trying to find an agent, and then having that agent shop your book, and then waiting for that publisher to actually get your book out there, which, and the timelines are normally longer than self-publishing. So again, perseverance, stick with it, and your persistence and perseverance will definitely pay off.
And I'm curious around that. I mean, what kind of, I mean, I know you mentioned the kind of empty nest. Was that what finally prompted you to sit down and say, I'm going to tackle this idea that's been with me for years?
Well, yes, that was definitely part of it, Jeff, because, you know, I think all writers, cliche if it sounds that way, however, forgive me, but all writers feel that they have this work bursting to get out of them. All creatives, whether you're a painter, a writer, musician, you feel you have this work inside you. It needs to get out. You need to share it with the world. But then, of course, it's this dichotomy, because then you're all nervous about whether or not the world's going to enjoy it the way you do. But yeah, it was something I had to get out. And I felt, you know, almost like you feel your clock ticking, in that, you know, okay, even if I live to be 100, if I want to write 20 books, say, which is at least my plan, if I don't start in my 50s, that would at least take me to my 70s, potentially 80s. So I just felt this innate need to get started.
Sure. And can you talk about, I mean, you said that you decided to go the indie publishing or self-publishing route, as opposed to all of the querying for traditional publishing, et cetera. Can you just tell us how that self-publishing journey has gone for you thus far?
Well, thus far it's worked out really well. I enlisted the help of a great self-publishing assist company called Friesen Press. I consider them kind of like the Cadillac or Mercedes of self-publishing assist, in terms of at least Canada, where I am. So I found that the process was very similar, from what I understand it, from my traditionally published friends to, traditionally
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Being traditionally published, I mean, the reverse, obviously, in that you're paying a self-assist company upfront money rather than receiving an advance. And, you know, I found that the royalties seem to be a bit more competitive with the self-publishing end.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's been fantastic. I mean, again, the journey is very similar with editing and proofreading and copy edits and book evaluations and, you know, cover design, and from my understanding, everything's pretty well the same. It's just that, again, you're not, you don't have the, unfortunately, you don't have the big marketing machine that traditionally publishing houses have behind you, and you have to do predominantly all your own marketing and, you know, pumping your book. However, you know, again, there is a level of creative freedom I think you enjoy in self-publishing that is second to none. So I don't think you can go wrong with either route, but as I said, the clock was ticking, and I felt it'd be a lot faster for me to go the self-publishing route.
Sure. So what novels or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Oh, well, the list is long. I tend to read now a lot more self-published books of my self-published colleagues. You know, just because I'm immersed kind of in that milieu. You know, but I can name so many fantastic books. I mean, Bjorn Larsson is an amazing writer. He writes one of his books, Children, Norse mythology, a great book. Holly Tinsley, We Men of Ash and Shadow. She's just recently become a semi-finalist in the self-published fantasy blog off, hosted by famous author Mark Lawrence. You know, The Neglected Merge, Eve Kokoshi, she writes fantasy, utopian romance. You know, R.P. Lauer, Scars of Gaia, another fantasy type book. You know, there's so many going on. I read a lot of trad published books, obviously. John Gwynn, one of my favorites. Shadow of the Gods, his recent book was fantastic that I read. You know, so yeah, there's so many that I could list.
So I'm curious, did you participate in the self-published fantasy blog off?
Yeah, coincidentally, I've put my book in there. It's you know, it's kind of like this big leap of faith, and it's fantastic. It's an honor to be part of it. It's very nerve-wracking. the competition goes all the way till next year.
Yeah.
They're just getting into the semi-finalists stages slowly now. So it's nerve-wracking waiting to hear what the feedback on your book is. But I mean, the thing about that competition is this: the caliber is so high. There's so many amazing books. And the bloggers themselves will say it comes down to taste a lot, whether or not you manage to advance through the round. So, and the odds are stacked against you, but you're hoping for some positive feedback from the viewers at a minimum, and hopefully even if your book doesn't advance, that it just garners you that larger audience, all the exposure that comes to the contest. And, you know, someone will find your book that likes it, even if the bloggers don't. And that's the way I think you have to look at it in terms of optimism. So
I agree. I'm actually a reviewer. There's a science fiction, a self-published science fiction blog off that Hugh Howey just started.
Yes.
And we're just getting into it now. We haven't even started reading. We're in the preliminary stages. But I'm looking forward to that. I agree. I think it's a good opportunity to expose people to a variety of indie and self-published novels. So where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your novels?
Well, my website is www.plstewart.com. you can visit my website. I have a media page where I typically list any interviews and podcasts I've been part of, any newspaper or magazine articles written about myself for the book. You can obviously visit my website as well for my blog and any updates about publication, et cetera, for next upcoming novels. I'm very active on social media, especially Twitter. My Twitter handle is at PL Stuart Writes. My DMs are open. Feel free to DM me there if you have a question or like to chat about writing. You know, I follow back almost all creatives on Twitter. So I'm also on Facebook as well, at PL Stuart Writes. I'm fairly active there. So, yep, those are the best places to get a hold of me.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with PL Stuart, author of the novel A Drowned Kingdom. The novel is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And PL, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, great. Now, stay tuned as P.L. Stuart reads from his novel, A Drowned Kingdom.
Within the outermost two rings of the Circle City was where most of our capital's great populace lived out their lives, in wide streets laid first in mud and then covered with cobblestones. The Circle City was where there were frenetic shops and squares, and where the traders called out their wares to entice customers to partake of the greatest selection of goods found anywhere in the world. It was where the rich and highborn could purchase gems, spices, and exotic fabrics, and the poorer citizens could get their wheat, fruit, and meats. In the great city, there were great pillared temples erected to the worship of the single God, the true God, and the bell tolled twice every 6 days to summon the congregation to prayers. In our capital, one also found taverns, gaming houses, and brothels, which plied to a different kind of supplicant than those who patronized the temple. Those supplicants worshipped the ale flask, the rolling dice, and the flesh of painted women, who offered other intoxicating pleasures that did not come in a cup or on a board. The capital held the lofty manors of lords, with their perfumed gardens and wide courtyards. In the Circle City could be found sweaty gymnasiums where the knights, the armed protectors of our realm, and sworn servants of the single god, trained with blunted swords and thin wooden shields. Our capital kept mighty stables that housed horses those knights rode for war and peaceful use. One would find there that better off lived in houses of stone and clay than the less fortunate in ones formed of wattle and thatch. Every day, more than 10 times 10,000 people enjoyed all the excitement and bustle of the world's greatest city. In the very central part, the innermost ring, at the heart of the Circle City, the main building, even though it was surrounded by its own moat, was entirely enclosed within the embrace of 40-foot-high concrete walls. That building was the castle of the kings of my island, called the High Castle. That mighty fortification was adjoined to the great triangle temple, with its shining gold dome roof and the royal mausoleums, known to the common folk as the Grey Beds. It was where the great kings, queens, lords, and ladies of the land were entombed in stone, as was befitting the most noble, and slept in eternal splendor beneath the mausoleum's wide, pale, and silent arches. The High Castle was topped by the Spire of Atalan, highest building in the land, which was a massive gleaming tower pointing to heaven like a finger showing the way to God. It was at the bottom of the spire where the great Hall of Kings was constructed. In that hall, the King of our island sat on his throne, surrounded by great statues of his forebears and priceless embroidered textiles, and warded by his personal guard. The throne of our king, at the center of the hall, was mounted on a 10-foot-high dais, with stairs used to ascend to the seat, and was so elevated that it earned the king's throne the name of the High Chair. Though whenever I heard that name, I giggled irrationally, thinking spitefully of Earthel when he became king, like a spoiled brat in a raised wooden stool for toddlers, kicking his legs impotently as they hung off the ground, not the austere seat reserved for the most exalted royal rump. From the rear of the Hall of Kings, curved staircases rose into the spire, and on those floors above the hall were the chambers of all the royal family, including my own, as second prince, several stories up, just below those of Earthel, who in turn resided on the level beneath the massive apartments of the king himself. Those apartments for the sovereign had been turned from the original smaller solar and bedroom of Atalan IV into a massive, sumptuous suite that spanned the entire floor.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.